You are listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And today we are going to be reviewing Heavy Liquid by Paul Pope. And this is a book that's been around for
10 years.
Quite a while. And I guess the reason why we are reviewing it and decided to pick it up is because it just recently came out in paperback. It's been hardbound for quite a while. And so it piqued our... It is a book that I've been wanting to read for quite some time and have just never picked up for one reason or the other. And so when I saw that it came out in paperback, I was like, let's jump on it, you know?
Right. And Jason down at Floating World, who, you know, is always quick to point out something new and exciting, he pulled me over and showed me his stack of Heavy Liquid books and was like, this is fantastic, you know, this is one of my favorites, you should read it. And so when someone says to me, you know, this is one of my favorite books, it, you know, that's enough to make me look at it and go, okay, you know, it's worth taking a look at. So
especially Jason, I mean, he knows a lot about comics,
right?
And especially underground comics,
so. So there you go. You guys want someone who can recommend underground and small press comics to you? That's Jason at Floating World.
Yeah. So this is written and drawn and colored by Paul Pope. He does it all. And this is a story about S, who has made a score on what is called Heavy Liquid. It's this substance that nobody really knows anything about and is pretty underground, and he's been using it as a drug.
Right.
And it can be used as an explosive as well.
Yeah, it seems to be this very mysterious compound that is almost like an all-in-one. I mean, it does everything. It can be mixed with other elements. It explodes. It's corrosive when it's heated and then, you know, skimmed off the top. Then it's, you know, it has hallucinogenic powers. I mean, it's all these different things.
Yeah.
And like you said, there's a mystery surrounding it that nobody knows where it came from. And nobody knows how it got on the market.
Yeah.
So it's the rarest substance in the world, basically. And as such, everybody wants it.
Yeah.
And S has basically had this land in his lap.
Yeah, so the score isn't detailed in here. We come in after...
Right.
The score has happened, and him and his partner, Luna, are splitting up their shares and separating ways so that they don't get caught by who he calls the clowns. And they are the ones that are trying to get it back. They got it stolen from them.
Right. And so we have the clowns who are chasing him, but at the same time, he's made this score, and he has a buyer for it.
Uh-huh.
So it's not... We don't have the, okay, now what do I do with it? No, he already has to make a delivery of it, and that's in itself... You would think that's where the story would end, is he has to go and make the delivery, but that's actually where the story begins.
Yeah, because once he makes the deal with the... They call him the collector, who is a big-time art collector... once he makes a deal with him and drops the substance off, that's just the beginning of it, because now the collector wants him to find the best sculptor, the best artist sculptor who dropped off the grid like 5 years ago.
Right.
And to make a statue out of this substance. So he wants the best sculptor to make a statue
out of the most rare substance material,
which makes sense. I mean, there's this whole description in there about how if you're, you know, richer than God and everything, you know, what is it that you want when you surround yourself with everything that you can have? You want what you can't have, which makes sense, and leads S on the quest to find Rodan, who he has a history with that we aren't quite clear about. As soon as we find out that it's Rodan, he knows, and we find out that he knows her somehow in his past, but we haven't been revealed that.
Right. And he says that he could have found her anytime he wanted over the past six years, but he never really wanted to.
And somehow we find out through here that he is a finder. That's
what he does.
What he does is finds stuff for rich people.
Right.
It almost seems, because this is futuristic and he's using some sort of device, it kind of seemed to me like it connects through the internet or an internet type technology into his eye, and he can search an incredibly vast amount of information using it. And so he was almost like an internet hacker in some ways. Like, that's how he finds people, is through using this device and gathering the information. So that's what it is that he does. But it seems like he's more capable than that, because when he's getting chased by the clowns and everything, like, he's pulling moves off and doing things, and he's very capable at getting away from these mob gangsters.
Right.
So he's an incredibly capable person, both intelligently and also physically, and just street knowledge.
Right. He's almost a futuristic hard-boiled detective, in the sense that, yeah, he's smart, he's intelligent, but he should be doing better for himself than he is.
Yeah, and he can take care of himself.
And he can take care of himself. And there's sort of a parallel to that in the storytelling. There's a lot of this first-person voice-over narrative that happens in the storytelling that is reminiscent of the hard-boiled detective.
It kind of reminded me of Blade Runner, in that that's the way Blade Runner was supposed to be, the original version, not the director's cut. The original version was that hard-boiled detective where he has a voiceover the whole time, and it's kind of like this sci-fi and noir-esque.
Right. And the atmosphere, the setting of Heavy Liquid, I found to be reminiscent of Blade Runner, not in the mega city volume or, you know, background, but in the fact that it's dark. It's hot and humid there. It's raining. It's wet. There's that whole feeling of this that you had in Blade Runner, that everything, it's almost that climate change that, you know, you expect in the post-apocalyptic world type deal, where the environment's been ruined. I kind of got that same feeling with Heavy Liquid. So that was, again, for me, another Blade Runner type connection.
Yeah, so eventually he finds Rodin in Paris, and he contacts her, and we find out that the reason she doesn't want to see him or their past is that they tried Heavy Liquid together for the first time, essentially, and it really messed with Rodin, and she had a bad trip off of it or whatever, and he's been addicted to it ever since, and so she wants nothing to do with him. Kind of like, I guess, somebody that had a bad experience with heroin or alcohol would not want to be with an alcoholic or drug heroin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, so on the one hand, his quest really parallels that of the collector. The collector has everything, and so he wants the one thing he can't have. And S, who really doesn't have anything.
But you get the sense that he doesn't really want anything. He doesn't have that need like the collector does. He doesn't want everything, so he has everything that he wants.
But he does. But he also, he can't have her.
Yeah.
He can't have Rodin. And she has been very clear that she's the one that split them up. She's the one that doesn't want to see him. And so, for him, it is a very parallel quest, that while he wants her, while the collector wants her skills, and she doesn't want to be found, S wants her, and she doesn't want to be found, or wants her affection, and she doesn't want to be found.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting, that S is, he's a pretty asexual guy in this story, that there are several women that he comes into contact with in this story, and at no time through his actions or through the voiceover is there any kind of hint of desire on his part for that individual.
No, he walks this story very Morrissey-esque, like, he has no sexual drive whatsoever. And I thought that that was very interesting because that's where it splits from the hard-boiled detective right. who is a sexual being and...
falls for the femme fatale.
Yeah. And women are drawn to him
right.
at the same time. And he enacts on the women being drawn to him.
Right.
S is a completely different character mm-hmm. who doesn't enact on that ability that these women are drawn to him.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that really the only desire we see from him is for the heavy liquid. Mm-hmm. And even then, he has a real love-hate relationship with it that he mentions several times. As the story progresses, he's gone, you know, a day without it, 2 days without it, and it's the longest he's gone without it, and he's surprised he's been able to go this long, and can he hold out any longer, and all these things. But at the same time, it's not that he has a negative association with it. He's yeah. not trying to stop.
Yeah.
He likes taking it.
Yeah.
And so it is this sort of pulling on him both ways, is, you know, how long can he hold out? How long can he resist the urge to give in to his desires like that?
Yeah.
And so I found it strange. That was the only time that he showed any kind of feeling in that manner. And I think that when you find the great reveal at the end as to what heavy liquid is,
mm-hmm.
it adds a little bit more power to that, especially given the fact that he's not having this kind of intimate relationship with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then to find out, you know, the big reveal of the heavy liquid, it adds a new dimension to it.
No, it totally did. This is an incredibly complex book, not just in the narrative and the story, but also in the themes that are brought up and the genres that it pulls off of, because this is a genre-bending book. There's no genre that it really slips into easily. And that's what I found was really nice about just the story and the narrative of it. And then you add to it the art, which we haven't even discussed yet. I mean, I was completely blown away by this art. And it starts on the very first page where all you see is this, these fireworks going off, and then this big balloon being floated throughout the city. Like, uh-huh. I was just absolutely drawn into the art in this book. And I think that it probably took me twice as long to read, just because I was just poring over pages and looking at the art. Like, Paul Pope is an artist.
He is. I wasn't as taken by the art because I felt like while there were some incredibly fantastic and dynamic pages in here, some of the fight scenes were very, very good. I don't know what it was about the art for me that I had a problem with. There were some character design that I thought was absolutely brilliant. I mean, the guy who's sort of leading the clowns,
all the clowns had great design.
He has a very kind of
it's a cubist kind of a look, like,
yeah, where you're getting the whole Picasso trying to see two dimensions at the same time, so you're seeing it from the front and from the side type look, and it's very striking and very grotesque and very scary. I mean, really, you can see how this would be a terrifying thing. And then having
I would love to have this mask. Having, like a Halloween mask.
Yeah, having S's disguise. S is walking around with a giant goldfish head. I mean, I thought some of the design work was fantastic, but I think that some of the way that just people moved through the city and the way that, I don't know, some of the backgrounds were rendered, not the backgrounds where you're supposed to spend time poring over them. I thought those were wonderfully pulled together, but some of the other, just, you know, the backgrounds of rooms and how like the lockers where he's going into you know, the station and pulling out a duffel bag out of the locker. Just the way the locker is laying against the wall. I mean,
do you have like a specific page?
I'm looking, where was it? On page, page like 30 or page 29 and 30. Like those lockers there, just the way they're laying against the wall, just, I don't know. It felt really disjointed. I felt like there was, in the way he's going down the stairs on page 29, the proportion and perspective on the arch is all wrong there. And so I felt like, while the character detail was there,
I feel like that adds to like the atmosphere and the strangeness of the environment. And yeah. So that's what I kind of enjoyed. Nothing, you walk into a room in this, and it's a room that you could walk into in at this day and time, but because everything was like a little bit askewed, and a little bit screwy, it didn't feel like a safe place or like a normal place that you would walk into. And that's what I kind of liked about it.
Yeah, see, but I mean, I look at like the bottom page 34, which is the same place. I mean, we're at like Union Station or something. The bottom of page 34, where he's walking up the stairs, and you have him, and then this feeling that it's, you know, there's separate him, which he talks about when he's taking the heavy liquid, how there's almost two of him. And that's a much better rendering of Union Station or wherever this is than before. It still is rough. It still is, you know, more of an impression than a photorealism, but it doesn't pull you away from the story. At least it didn't pull me away from the story. And that's where
I feel like the difference is like now that he's taken the liquid and he has like that perceptional awareness or that super ability that he gets when he takes the heavy liquid, that's why it's drawn different.
Yeah, I could see that.
I mean, I guess that's what I drew from these pages. Like, when you see him, he's had that heavy liquid, it feels like he's just sort of smooth and, you know, has some sort of super perception going on or whatever. I don't know what it is, but...
Yeah, see, I mean, like, when he takes it for the first time, I mean, it's a full page there when he takes it for the first time, and I love the just visual elements that Pope is using to show that. I mean, not only do you have him inverted on the page, basically being on the ceiling and on the ground at the same time, but then you see this elongating of the arms and the fingers and all these things happening around him. The walls are kind of bowing a little bit there. I really like that. I thought that was very visually striking there. And so it was things like that. I mean, like I said, this is an artistic book. He's not just drawing things to draw things. Like I said, I thought the character work was very good. I just had problems in some of like the background scenes and some of the environment.
Yeah, I didn't. I enjoyed this book thoroughly, and especially for the art. I mean, the story is great as well, and the characterization and the narrative is great as well. But man, the art just blew me away and sucked me right in. To this story. I loved it, and I can totally picture this as a kind of a walking movie. I felt like it was very fluid between the panels, and I would never want to see this as a movie, but I felt like this did such a great job of showing motion panel to panel that I felt like it almost moved on its own.
Right. It does really actually work very well as a complete story, and like you said, it flows in a natural progression. And that was one of my notes on this, was that this originally was published over 5 issues. This came out in individual issue format, and this reads so much better as a graphic novel. Imagine. There's no way that I would have sat through this as individual issues. There's nothing individual issue wise that stops me and says, I have to know what happens next.
Yeah, no, this is a long form story. Right. It's not like Why the Last Man where it ends on a cliffhanger every single issue and you've got to get to the next issue. This is very much
this is for the
payoff in the end. Like, you are reading this for the long term story.
Right. This is plotted for 200 pages. This isn't plotted for 22 pages at a pace. The only place where I felt like this was padded out, where there I shook my head at it, was there's an entire section, and it's got to be close to 20 pages, involving this gang of girls called the Fork Tongues, the Park Slope Fork Tongues. And it really, they don't serve any real purpose in this story other than to be one more piece of set dressing for S to run through.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree with you. And I felt the same way reading through this. Like, I kept expecting something later on in the book to pop up as a reason why this happened. But there really wasn't any reason for it to happen. And it didn't feel as natural as everything else. Everything in this book just sort of unfolds naturally. And you feel like, yeah, that would be the natural next step that somebody would take in real life. And this just, even though it's him bursting in on this scene, it just didn't feel as natural as everything else. It wasn't as though he made the choice to get involved with this gang. Just the unfolding of events didn't feel as natural as everything.
Right.
That being said, it can be read, and you can still enjoy, you know, this book as a whole with that part in there. It didn't take me out as much as it sounds like it took you out.
It was just one of those things where everything else fit together so well. There weren't wasted characters in this that, you know, S and Luna start the story together, and while Luna drops out of the story, she doesn't drop out of his consciousness. She's there. Mm-hmm. Luis, who basically was the one who ended up stealing the heavy liquid from the clowns, we never see Luis except for in flashbacks, but again, he still plays an important role in the story. He's not a wasted character. All these people, even Zhao Tu, the kid who's going to be the one who actually casts the art piece.
It's what you're really describing is all these people have an influence on S and his actions and his feelings about things. And
This one group where, and that's the thing, is that the reason it stuck out for me so much is that because everybody, he kept coming back to everybody, and you could see how everybody fit into this larger picture. I kept waiting for the explanation of how this girl group fit into the larger picture, or his interaction with one of the girls in particular. And all that I really came up with was that they were a big MacGuffin. I mean, they were there to get rid of some characters and introduce or basically put S and the man from the department on the same track.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's how the man from the department really gets on S's trail, is in that scene. And that's how you shift from the clowns to the man from the department.
He could have walked into an open room and jumped out and gotten away some other way.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it didn't.
It didn't.
And I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
It was wasted characters and wasted scenes in an otherwise very well-paced book and very well, I don't know, edited. And not in the, you know, in the self-editing, in the storyteller looking at it and saying, do I have to have it? Yeah.
It was efficient storytelling, except for that. And I totally agree. And I felt like when we were getting into that, I kept waiting, like you said, I kept waiting later for the character to reappear or there to be some impact. And there really wasn't any.
Right. No. And that's the thing is that this book is about impact. I mean, this book has a pretty solid reveal at the end, and it is the kind of reveal that makes you sit back and go, huh, wow, okay. And you want to go back now and kind of reread the story with the reveal in the back of your mind and see how everything adds to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having that wasted scene in there just didn't push it along. It felt like the kind of scene that, I mean, you said you didn't want to see this as a movie. I wouldn't mind seeing this as a movie. I think it'd make a pretty good movie.
But no, I think it would make a good movie. That wasn't my point. Yeah. My point is that I think that it stands well enough on its own, and the motion is showing there, and you can feel the motion. Like, I think that it would make, like, a good movie, just like I felt, like, Fight Club made a great movie, and in some ways I feel that Fight Club is a better movie than the book.
Uh-huh.
This could make a great movie, but I feel like this stands alone on its on its own.
No, I would enjoy seeing the movie. I was just feeling like that was the kind of scene, the scene with the girls, that would have been added into a Hollywood movie. You know what I mean? It's the kind of thing they would pad it out a little bit, or, you know, we need to you know, sex it up a little bit, and so we're going to have these tough chicks in there, or that kind of deal. And that was the thing, is that I didn't feel like this book needed any of that. I felt like there was enough action, there was enough drama, there was enough tension without it.
And atmosphere, because it did add a little bit to how this world was constructed a little bit, but I didn't feel that it needed it.
Right.
There was enough atmosphere and understanding of how this world worked without that scene.
Right, right. You know, and there were some very interesting, I don't know, quirks about the world. I mean, that was the thing, is that everything in this world was kind of quirky and off from where we are right now. Which, you know, like you said, I mean, with the art, it just kind of added to the sense of this is our world, but it's not our world. This is, you know, just a little bit in the future type deal. And, you know, the former, what was she, a supermodel or something, who lived with the six-year-old genius. I thought that those were characters that it was almost like Miss Havisham from Great Expectations, that she lives in this house and she is trying desperately to hold on to her past.
Yeah.
And, you know, where Miss Havisham keeps everything exactly the way it was, this woman continues to basically just get the implants and upgrades in her body so that she will continue to live on and on and on. And then she has the little six-year-old girl who she just indulges however she can.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw that as a very, you know, Great Expectations moment, and how you can have some of these other familiar elements thrown in with this, you know, neo-futuristic twist to them. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, this book was a lot of fun to read. You got caught up in the chase scenes, and
I had a hard time putting it down, and it's paced so well because those chase scenes, man, they are frenetic and they move quick, and I was like moving through the book really quick, and then he'll just slow it down with a scene going to somebody else or something like that, and it was paced very well.
Uh-huh.
It was never too fast for too long that you were missing story or you were moving too fast through it, and it was never too slow for too long that you got bored with it.
Right.
It was really very well paced.
Yeah, I can see why this is a favorite for a lot of people. You know, I can see why, you know, this book really took, you know, Paul Pope and launched him to the next level. And, you know, and I can see why it stands out as such an important piece for Vertigo. I mean, you look at when it was published in, you know, 98 and 99, you know,
that's really hard to believe, because I feel like this could have been put out this year.
Uh-huh.
and stand very well against the other books that were published out this year. It's hard for me to believe that this was put out in 98.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, is that it really does, you know, it shows how far ahead of its time it was.
Because, yeah, because this art, I feel like this art is ahead of right now, is very forward looking for right now. And so to imagine it being 10 years ago that this was made, I mean, this book must have been like a bombshell for people reading it. Kind of like how I felt that David Mazzucchelli's book, Asterisk Polyp, was received this year.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like that same sort of, it must have been like the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I just know that at the time, I mean, Vertigo was in this weird sort of what now stage. It was post Sandman, which, you know, had really been their defining book, and it was pre, you know, Why the Last Man and Fables and all those other books that have really taken Vertigo and pushed it so far ahead right now. And so, you know, kind of an experimental time, and that's definitely what this book is, especially when you put it in the context of being 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of book that I can see being published right now. Like you said, it holds up so well right now. And even now, it is a fairly experimental book.
Yeah.
It's not like everything else that's out there, and it definitely does not fit into to the Vertigo mold of what's out there right now.
Oh, definitely not.
So yeah, this definitely pushes some artistic and storytelling boundaries that, you know, are still, I mean, 10 years after the fact, it still is pushing boundaries.
Yeah. And $25, that's a fair price for this book. It seems about average for a book this length, but for the content that's in it, it's some of the best art I've seen all year. I really enjoyed not just the artistic style, but the design, the character design, and a lot of the design elements that went in here, the coloring and everything else.
Right.
And so I think that this was a really good book for the price.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, and especially now, you may be able to start picking up the hardcover cheaper. That, you know, a lot of times people, when something comes out in paperback and it's a little bit cheaper, they start to get rid of their hardcovers as such. And so I think that you know, for people that are real hardcover fanatics that have held off on buying the hardcover version of this because of the price point, they may be able to pick up the hardcover now for a cheaper price point, or pick up the soft cover because they thought the hardcover was too expensive.
That's kind of what happened for me. I mean, I never really heard that much. I heard that it was good, but I never really wanted to pick up the hardcover. And so when the soft cover came out, I was like, this is a great opportunity to jump on it. And now I'd kind of like to go back and buy the hardcover, because I felt like this was such a quality work that it would be worthy of a hardcover.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I thought that some of the added things in here were nice. There wasn't a whole lot, but there were sketches and character designs, and it's interesting to see how some of these things evolved. I thought that some of the work that went into some of the characters, like or some of the background pieces, the Twister bike, which I thought was just a fun little you know, element that that played in one of the chase scenes. You know, he's got the schematics for it in here, and I thought that was just a lot of fun to have. And then there were the covers in the back and all sorts of stuff. And so really, I thought that there was enough matter in here that, you know, it added something to it as well. It really did.
Yeah. It was a thoroughly enjoyable book all the way around.
I agree. Definitely something that when someone says, do you have something a little different?
Yeah. Oh,
I'll pull it out and let people take a look at it.
You have been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. Thanks for listening.